The reading is John 17, verses 20 to 26, and it's on page 1085 in the Church Bibles. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am and to see my glory, the glory you have given me because you loved me before the creation of the world. Righteous Father, though the world does not know you, I know you, and they know that you have sent me. I have made you known to them and will continue to make you known in order that the love you have for me may be in them and that I myself may be in them.
Well, we've heard talk about the Charter Fair. Imagine if next Saturday morning you're here, perhaps helping, perhaps just wandering around the stalls. There's stalls selling plants, jams, cakes, books, all kinds of stalls. There's stalls selling you activities you can join in with, local societies and clubs that you might join. And imagine if amongst the stalls there was a stall selling fireworks. And it said, come buy fireworks, enjoy the colour, the excitement, the brightness, the beauty. Bargain prices. Come and buy them. Well, it wouldn't be allowed, would it? You can't just sell fireworks like that. Certainly not second-hand fireworks. Yes, fireworks are beautiful, exciting, wonderful, something to be enjoyed, but only in the right context. There need to be parameters. There need to be rules for where fireworks can be used, how they can be used. The same is true of sexual intimacy. It's what the song is helping us to understand in part. Exciting, beautiful, powerful, but in the wrong context, in the wrong place, without the right parameters, you'll be burned, scarred. This is week 5 of working our way through the Song of Songs. If you're new this week, you're jumping in, well, more than partway through. We've only got 1 week left next week. But as we've worked our way through this song, we've been listening in, particularly to the voice of a man and a woman and their love for one another. Solomon and the Shulamite woman. We don't know her name. We have learned that Shulam is the female version of Solomon, both meaning shalom in the Hebrew, peace, wholeness, completeness. Here are, if you like, this perfect couple. We followed them and listened to their desire right at the beginning. Remember, we jumped in right at the deep end. We heard the proposal. We saw their marriage. But as we've gone along, as we've listened to their story, or more the poetry of their story, we've recognized too that this song of this couple is pointing us to a greater song, a greater story of love, the Bible story of love, the big picture. God's love for his people, Jesus' love for his church. The love that we're all invited into. And so as we've gone along, we've tried to make note of what does this teach us about human relationships, but then in particular, spending more time, what does this teach us about our relationship or our potential relationship with God? We're going to do the same again today. Last week we saw that after marriage, the next chapter, if you like, in their story was struggle. We saw the idol of comfort get in the way of their relationship. Well, we left them last week after she had been searching for him. It looked like they were going to be reunited. She saw him back in the garden. And now we listen in again as their relationship deepens. We're jumping in at chapter 6, verse 4, and our title for today is Deeper. Solomon is speaking, and we hear again his desire for his wife as he uses images from around Israel to delight in her beauty. Again, we've recognized as we've gone, the poetry for us is a bit clunky, but we still understand something of what he's saying and rejoicing in. Chapter 6, verse 4, "You're as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem, as majestic as troops with banners. Turn your eyes from me, they overwhelm me." And then we hear repeats of metaphors that he's already used earlier in the song. "Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Gilead. Your teeth like a flock of sheep coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is missing. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of pomegranate." This repetition reminds us that relationships aren't linear. It's not a straight line direction. No, there's a sense of circling that goes on in any relationship, any friendship, and any marriage. Enjoying the same things. Enjoying one another's company. Enjoying one another's character. Growing deeper, understanding more. Without growing bored or stale. And Solomon's certainly not looking to move on to someone else. No, just as she has said of him that he was one in a thousand, so now he says of her, she is uniquely special to him. The real Solomon was known for his many wives. But listen to these words here, verse 8, 60 queens there may be and 80 concubines and virgins beyond number. But my dove, my perfect one is unique, the only daughter of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The young women saw her and called her blessed. The queens and concubines praised her. And then we hear those friends, we hear the praising of this woman. Verse 10, "Who is this that appears like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, majestic as the stars in procession?" She's a sky full of stars, as Coldplay would say. Such a heavenly view. Traditionally, the next words are her words. Verse 11, "I went down to the grove of nut trees to look at the new growth in the valley, to see if the vines had budded or the pomegranates were in bloom." Remember back in chapter 2, it was spring. Birds were singing, the flowers were budding, there was blossom on the trees. It was the season of love. But now she's tentative. After her rejection of him, because of her love of the duvet, is it still the season of love? Is their love okay? Will he really take her back? Well, before she realizes it, she's swept off her feet by him again. Verse 12, "Before I realized it, my desire set me among the royal chariots of my people." She's whisked away. And the friends cry out, "Come back. Come back, O Shulamite, come back. Come back that we may gaze on you." But Solomon replies, "No, she's not to be gazed on. Why would you gaze on the Shulamite as on the dance of the Mahanaim? That's the victory dance after a battle." And he whisks her off to praise her himself, to enjoy her himself. to be enjoyed by her. And again, the language surprises us for being in our Bibles. But it reinforces to us that sexual desire is God-given. Sexual pleasure is something that he's designed to be enjoyed within the safety of the covenant of marriage. Our world ignores this, doesn't it? Our culture teaches us otherwise, in books, in films, in TV, in songs, encouraged to ignore and diminish the power of sex and the place for sex. But to have sexual relations connects you on the deepest level. Like blue tack on a wall. Put it in place and it works. Take it away and it leaves a mark. And it's less good next time, less connecting. Damage is done. Multiple relations, damage is done. Multiple views of pornography, damage is done. It's a misuse of sex as God intended. Tim Keller, in his book, The Meaning of Marriage, puts it this way. If sex is a method that God intended to do whole life entrustment and self-giving, it should not surprise us that sex makes us feel deeply connected to the other person, even when used wrongly. Unless you deliberately disable it, or through practice you numb the original impulse, sex makes you feel personally interwoven and joined to another human being, as you are literally physically joined. In the midst of sexual passion, you naturally want to say extravagant things such as, I'll always love you. Even if you're not legally married, you may find yourself very quickly feeling marriage-like ties, feeling that the other person has obligations to you, but that other person has no legal, social, or moral responsibility even to call you back in the morning. This incongruity leads to jealousy and hurt feelings and obsessiveness if two people are having sex but not married. It makes breaking up vastly harder than it should be. It leads many people to stay trapped in relationships that are not good because of a feeling of somehow having connected themselves. Well, Solomon and the Shulamite women are married. They're united in covenant promises. There's safety here for them. We often speak of something going from head to toe, but Solomon moves from toe to head, delighting in his wife, mixing images of sexual pleasure with fruitfulness, which reminds us of God's directive in Eden of two becoming one flesh and being fruitful. We listen as he delights, chapter 7, verse 1. How beautiful your sandaled feet, O prince's daughter. Your graceful legs are like jewels, the work of an artist's hands. Your navel is a rounded goblet that never lacks blended wine. Your waist is a mound of wheat encircled by lilies. Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bath-Rabbin. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon looking towards Damascus. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. Your hair is like royal tapestry. The king is held captive by its tresses. How beautiful you are, and how pleasing, my love, with your delights. Your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I'll climb the palm tree, I'll take hold of its fruit. May your breasts be like clusters of grapes on the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. And she responds in kind. May the wine go straight to my beloved, flowing gently over lips and teeth. It's intimate, isn't it? It's uncomfortable to read and listen to sitting here in church. It's passionate. And intimacy is rightly linked to passion. Winston Smith, not the 1984 Winston Smith, but the author of a book called Marriage Matters, says this: intimacy is made up of at least two critical ingredients, being known and being safe. We experience intimacy when we feel known and understood, as well as safe, accepted and cared for by our spouse. And that's expressed in verse 10, isn't it? I belong to my beloved, and his desire is for me. Like any relationship, marriage needs curiosity to help it flourish. Communication to get to know, to understand, to trust, to entrust what's hard in life at the moment, what's good, what needs prayer. And there's a sense in which she might say, you know, he doesn't just know the contours of my body, he knows the contours of my life. And so she plans a romantic weekend away for them. Let's get away. Let's leave work behind and the kids behind. Let's have time for just us. Verse 11, come, my beloved, let's go to the countryside. Let's spend the night in the villages. Let's go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if their blossoms have opened, and if the pomegranates are in bloom. There I'll give you my love. The mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my beloved. She loves him. And she wants the world to know that. But culturally, they can't show their affection in public. And so she laments, chapter 8, verse 1, if only you were to me like a brother who was nursed at my mother's breasts. Then if I found you outside, I'd kiss you and no one would despise me. I would lead you and bring you to my mother's house, she who has taught me. I'd give you spiced wine to drink and the nectar of my pomegranates. Remember those two ingredients of intimacy? Being known and being safe. That's her experience, verse 3. His left arm is under my head. His right arm embraces me. And so again, we hear the warning after hearing this passion, hearing all that marital love, sexual love, all that it can be like, the warning, verse 4, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. It's powerful, it's beautiful, it's like a firework. It needs to be in the right parameters. Faithful, covenant, commitment to intimacy. So how does this help us in our relationship with Jesus? Well, that's where intimacy in marriage should point us. We've seen back in week one, marriage is supposed to be a picture. Picture for this life only that points us to the intimacy we could enjoy with God for eternity. So whether we're married or single, whether we've, as we've read through or listened to these verses, unmet desires have been stirred in us, lost desires have been felt by us, frustrated desires have been flagged to us. The picture that we see here should help us all, should point us all to the reality of Christ's love for us. So two questions to help us. Firstly, this. How does Jesus help us to have an ever-deepening intimacy with him? To help us, we're going to use those verses in John 17. Jesus' prayer. Remarkable prayer that he prayed on the night he was going to be arrested. And he prayed with us in mind. He prayed for those who would come to believe in him through the words of the disciples. That's us, isn't it? Well, he said this in John 17, verse 24. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am and to see my glory. Jesus desires deepening intimacy with us. He wants us to be with him. That's a remarkable thing to take in, isn't it? Jesus wants us to be with him. To see his glory. Verse 25, Righteous Father, though the world does not know you, I know you, and they know that you've sent me. I have made you known to them, and I will continue to make you known in order that the love that you have for me may be in them, and that I myself may be in them. Jesus has made himself known to us by making God the Father known to us. That's what Jesus said he was doing in the Gospels. He says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If we want to know what God is like, we need to look at Jesus. We can easily drift into our own impression of who we think God is or what he's like. But Jesus makes this remarkable claim. You want to know what God is like? Look at me. I will show you. And so we look at Jesus, we see his love, we see his passion, a passion that was particularly shown in what we call Passion Week, don't we? When he went to the cross to die for us, to bring us forgiveness for our sin, even our sexual sin, lifting our shame. Enabling us to entrust ourselves to him, our true selves, to be known and loved, and inviting us into the love of God, the love that God, Father, Son, and Spirit have had amongst themselves for eternity. You know, the Bible claims God is love. That is stronger than God might love or God could love. God is love. That's because of the mystery of what we call the Trinity. God is three persons. If God was one person, well, then through eternity, he'd have been on his own. Who could he love? He made us and one God and us, well, he could love, he might love. Do we know that he's loving? Could we say that he is love? Yes, because he's three persons. For eternity, always in that relationship, one with another. God is love, and he invites us into that love. That's an extraordinary invitation, isn't it? You accepted that invitation, invited into the love of God. You know, it's an invitation we all yearn for because we've all been wired for intimacy of relationship. Yes, with other human beings, but ultimately with God himself, made in the image of God, made for relationship, made for love. Jesus enables us to have ever deepening intimacy with him. Are you enjoying that, benefiting from that, growing in that, spending time with him, understanding his love for you more and more? Remember those verses from Ephesians, how wide and high and deep is the love of Christ. He loves you. Second application question. How might our intimacy with Jesus be seen in our love for each other? Jesus says in John 17, verse 22, I have given them, that's us if we're trusting in Jesus, I've given them the glory that you gave me. That's an extraordinary thing to say, isn't it? I've given them the glory that you gave me. He gives us a glory that he delights in as he changes us. And that glory isn't just an individual glory, it's a collective glory. When Solomon is praising and adoring his wife, it's striking how he uses place names. You notice that as we've worked our way through. Come back with me to chapter 6, Song of Songs, chapter 6. I want to show you how this works. Chapter 6, verse 4. You are as beautiful as Cheam, my darling, as lovely as Carshalton. Verse 6. Your hair is like a flock of school children descending down Sutton High Street. Verse 7. Chapter 7, verse 4. Your eyes are the pools of Bourne Hall, by the gates in your village. Your nose is like the Tower of Tolworth looking down towards Stoneleigh. Your head crowns you like Box Hill. Suddenly we're not thinking about her body, are we? We're thinking about places, geography. In the song, those places are all over Israel. And that in turn represents all the people of God. It's a bit like in Revelation 21, we hear a new Jerusalem is coming down out of heaven from God, dressed as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. It's the people of God, all of God's people, together. There's a collective beauty, a collective glory that God gives his people. I've given them a glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, says Jesus, John 17, verse 23. So that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. In the television show Friends, the character Joey gets a license to conduct a wedding of Chandler and Monica. And as he's working out what he's going to say at this wedding, he comes up with this. Speaking of their love, he says, it's a love based on giving and receiving, as well as having and sharing. And the love that they give and have is shared and received. And through this having and giving and sharing and receiving, we too can share and love and have and receive. He delivers it in a way which is supposed to be funny, as he's sort of going round and round in circles, trying to convey what married love is. Friends gets a lot of things wrong about sex and marriage. But Joey gets a lot of things right in that speech. The love of Christ shouldn't just stay within a couple if it's a married couple, or even within a church, The love of Christ should flow. Jesus speaks here of a unity. Having received the love of God, it should bring a unity, a giving and receiving and sharing with one another. A unity that isn't just a spoken unity, but a lived unity. That involves sacrificing for each other, knowing each other, being in each other's lives. It means, as Bruce prayed earlier, there shouldn't be loneliness amongst us. Shouldn't be going through grief alone. Shouldn't be enjoying things alone. Life should be shared. Our intimacy with Jesus should flow into our intimacy with each other. That can't be contained within 2 hours on a Sunday morning, or a short talk over coffee after the Sunday service. No, it's life lived together, time made to serve together, to know each other, to help each other, to care for each other. And Jesus says, if that happens, then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. How might our intimacy with Jesus be seen in our love for each other?